I think that the question that we have to ask ourselves as humans is, why are we strangely attracted to this technology, but also scared to death of it? And so the thing that I think may be dead wrong is that this could be apocalyptic, or that it will be for humanity. I loved what you said about how AI is here to reveal us. In the book, as you know, I talk about AI being a cosmic mirror to humanity. I actually think that it's destined to have more and more of us go inside, remember who we are, and what reality really is. So while AI will be a crucible for humanity to pass through, and while it will cause some pain, unfortunately, it seems like we as humans need pain sometimes to make progress.
Welcome. According to a recent Goldman Sachs report, artificial intelligence could replace the equivalent of 300 million full-time jobs. But is work the only challenge we face with AI? Or is there a far bigger societal, psychological issue that we've all got to examine? Well, our guest today says that there are far bigger issues that each of us must face if we're going to thrive in the age of AI. Welcome to the Dov Barron Show. Come for the stories, stay for the learning. I'm your host, Dov Barron. I advise high-performing leaders and organizations how to harness their emotional source code to transform their tribe. Our guest today is Jeff Birmingham. He's the author of a book called The Last Book Written by a Human. Jeff Birmingham has built and backed hundreds of companies and ran for governor of Utah. But what's most interesting is not his resume, but rather his revelation. After years of chasing growth and power, he started asking the question few leaders dare to face. What does it mean to stay human when the machines start thinking for us? This conversation is about far more than the fear or the fantasy. It's about meaning. It's about faith. It's about courage to evolve. Where Jeff and I come together is that we both believe that AI isn't here to replace us. It's here to reveal us. So if you've ever wondered what the soul of leadership looks like in an algorithmic age, stay tuned. This one will make you think and maybe even remember what it means, really means, to be human. More about Jeff Birmingham in a moment. You're tuned into the Dov Barron Show. Each episode is an exploration into the minds of those who are shaping the world. Every episode is a raw, unscripted collaboration between my guest and me as we explore the truths behind leadership that few dare to admit or even recognize. We find guests for you who are sometimes unknown to the general public, but absolute titans in their field, the kinds of people that high-profile leaders turn to when they need an edge. If you're the kind of leader who craves depth over sound bites, hit that subscribe button right now, because this is where real thinkers come to sharpen their edge. Back to Jeff Birmingham. He grew up in Spokane, Washington, as the oldest of six kids, and started his first entrepreneurial venture at the age of 13 by buying a carpet cleaner and offering cleaning services to local businesses. Jeff sold his first tech startup while he was still an undergraduate at Brigham Young University, and he sold it to a NASDAQ-listed company. Then he leveraged his earnings to build a real estate portfolio worth over $2 billion. He's invested in nearly 100 startups, and as I said earlier, he ran for governor of Utah. Turn up the volume and help me to welcome author of The Last Book Written by a Human, Becoming Wise in the Age of AI, Jeff Birmingham. Welcome, Jeff.
Dov, it's good to be with you.
Thanks, mate.
Thanks for the kind introduction. Way too kind.
You're very welcome, man. I really appreciate it. Thanks for being here. There's a lot to get into with this, and you and I have already had some previous conversation about it that I think is just going to really be fascinating for people. But where I want to start here, because I think there's so many misconceptions about AI, what's the number one thing you think most people are dead wrong about when it comes to the future and AI?
I think that the question that we have to ask ourselves as humans is, why are we strangely attracted to this technology, but also scared to death of it? And so the thing that I think may be dead wrong is that this could be apocalyptic, or that it will be for humanity. I loved what you said about how AI is here to reveal us. In the book, as you know, I talk about AI being a cosmic mirror to humanity. I actually think that it's destined to have more and more of us go inside, remember who we are, and what reality really is. So while AI will be a crucible for humanity to pass through, and while it will cause some pain, unfortunately, it seems like we as humans need pain sometimes to make progress.
Well, that's definitely true psychologically. That is what drives us. We're driven by pain more than we are by pleasure. As you said, I think it's an interesting dichotomy with AI. I had a philosophical conversation, because I'm philosophical, with somebody recently, and I said, my question is, AI the new God or the new devil, right? And that was my question to them. And I said, because both of those things are incredibly appealing. Like, we know that, quote unquote, the devil seduces, but we're pulled to God because it's pure. But if you go to God, you get your ass slapped, or you get all kinds of things that happen. And I think in many ways, it's both. It's this sense of, we have to decide. It doesn't matter who you, quote, worship. But when you worship it, you live in fear of it. And I think that that's part of the problem. So we are asked to come together with it. I think you and I talked about that. I had Dakai on the show, who is one of the forefathers of AI. And he talks about raising AI as if it's a child. My friend Larry Wingert said, your kids are your own damn fault. So you're bitching about your kids are your own damn fault. Well, AI is exactly that way.
Amen. Yeah, two points that I would make to that. Is it the God or is it the devil? Depends on who we are, Doth. Who are we? Because it's a mirror. It acts as a reflection to humanity. I tend to think that God is awakening to itself here, that it has created an infinite amount of intelligent beings to come back to itself. So hopefully AI will reflect that godlike nature. I often say, I don't think the devil even exists. We're our own worst enemies.
Sure.
So in the age of AI, are we going to triple and quadruple down on our worst tendencies that we know lead to human division, human, you could even say, destruction? Or will we play a new game? I encourage readers in the book to pivot to a new game that reveals this godlike unity that I think is at the underpinning of what existence is. A second point, real quick. It is analogous to a child. Think of it like a child that we are raising up. In essence, with the creation of AI, one way to think about it is we as humans are bringing the economy or ethics, let's say, of heaven closer to earth. We're now creating something intelligent that we don't quite understand. It can be scary, but like I said, the opportunities for human flourishing have never been as great as well. And it depends on how we, quote unquote, raise this child. If we raise it with an eye towards human flourishing, I think it can help take us there. If we raise it with our shadow and the worst of ourselves, if we triple and quadruple down on greed, hate, and division, guess what it's going to feed back to us? More of that. And we are creating the devil, quote unquote. We are strengthening that aspect if we do that.
Yeah. What I find fascinating about it is, though, because I'm out looking at everything through the lens of psychology, and what I know for sure is human beings rarely change until they're confronted with something quite dramatic. We're also pretty lazy, meaning that we can say, yeah, this needs to change, but do bugger all about it. This may be politically incorrect. You can stick your thoughts and prayers where the sun doesn't shine. It isn't bringing anybody back from being shot. So it's like there's a laziness there. And now at the same time, many of those people who were sending thoughts and prayers, if their kid was shot, they'd change everything immediately. And so I think that that's part of the challenge. And I'm not talking about gun law here at all, actually. I was using that as a metaphor. A lot of what you talk about in the book that I really saw throughout the book was that you're asking us to come back to ourselves, to a better self. Because as you say in the subtitle, it's about wisdom, coming to wisdom. But the challenge is, Jeff, and this is my pushback on you, is wisdom is freaking rare, right? Intelligence is all over, but we all know some dumbass PhDs. Wisdom is something else. Wisdom is something that comes from failure and experience, not from the accumulation of information, but from the failure and experience that gave you another insight. And so That is where I go to, well, oh yeah, we got to get wise, but most people are too lazy. I'd rather be dumb and have a sandwich.
Well, that's why I think, Dov, here with AI, the obstacle becomes the way.
Yes.
You know, as is often the case, gloriously and painfully. And it becomes the way because of the pain that it's bringing. And that will roll out in three major areas. One, disinformation. We already see that.
Yep.
When we don't understand what's real, what's not, what's human, what's machine, that's going to cause a lot of friction and pain in our brains and our bodies. We already feel that, maybe especially in the younger generation. I do think, as a venture capitalist, like you said, that is invested in hundreds of technology companies, I do think that there's going to be job loss. We are going to have to grapple with, who are we when machines can do so much of what we're used to doing better than we can? The paradox in that is that I think it leaves us with our being. We aren't human doings, Dov. That may be in the air that we breathe. That may be the background that we have. But in the end, as you know, we are human beings, not doings. So as machines do more and more of what we're used to, we can come back to ourselves, back to our being. We can, as I say in the book, rehumanize ourselves in a magnificent way if we choose this path.
But the challenge is that we've identified ourselves as the doing. When you challenge someone's identity, you're going to get a lot of pushback. So if I'm the person who runs around proving that I'm valuable by doing more and more and more, and suddenly I can't do more and more and more because it's taken care of me, then who am I is the existential question that I jumped into in my 20s, but most people don't get to even in their 60s because it's just too freaking scary. And in the book, you tell a story about being at Brigham Young University in the MBA program. You talk about hitting a wall of emptiness, and you describe that moment as terrifying. And for me, that's the identity moment. Give our listeners, our viewers, a sense of that, and then tell us what it was like for you.
What was so interesting is I was running a multi-billion dollar private equity firm, investing $100 million of venture capital, a young father of four serving in my faith tradition or church. I grew up Mormon in a Christian tradition. I was doing all these things. And for some reason, and to tell you how bad this disease is, Dov, I thought I'm going to get an MBA, which was just ludicrous. So of course I had no time. I could only do that on nights and weekends. And as I look back, why in the hell was I doing that? Well, I know exactly why. It's what you said. We can always do more and then be more, but that's not true. In the doing is not where we find ourselves. It's not about doing, it's about being. And this struck me poignantly. One time I'm in a leadership class in MBA school. The professor says, I want everyone to think of the one or two things that are most motivating to you right now. And I kind of got excited. I've always been a big dreamer. So I'm like, okay, here we go. And I sat fully flat and empty. I tried again. Nothing was coming to me. Finally, two visions came, neither of which I'm proud of. The second of which drove me to see my first therapist in my life. The first one was this wild party scene. As a child of the 80s and 90s, I describe it in the book as like a mashup between a badass Yo MTV Raps episode and Cribs, you know? There were like illicit substances. By the way, mind you, I'm very Mormon at this time. I've never even tasted coffee or tea, let alone alcohol and drugs. There's stuff going around. It's white and powdery.
Must be talcum powder. Somebody's got a baby here. That must be what it is.
There are women with hardly any clothes on. Meanwhile, I've had sex with one woman, my wife. I've been married to her for 26 years. I talk about this in the book. But this is this wild party scene, and it alarmed me. Like, I knew in the end it would be empty, but it was showing me, damn, my soul really wants to be free right now. I felt confined by this doing. I was just overrun by it. The second vision was even more scary though, Dob. I literally saw myself close my laptop, quietly put it in the bag and drive to the Salt Lake City airport, which was 15 minutes down the road, and buy a one-way ticket to the furthest imaginable place. And just disappearing, literally leaving my soulmate, Sally, my four kids, my two business partners, the financial empire that I had built and was building, and just leaving it all. And it scared me to death. That stuck with me. And what I realized is in my climb to the top of my little mountain, and don't we all like to go there?
Oh, yeah.
Which is fine. But I had lost a lot of my being in that climb, not because I had done anything wrong necessarily, but because I had become addicted to doing. And I thought that by doing more, I could be more. And that's just not simply the case. I've been an adjunct professor now to thousands of entrepreneurial students at BYU. And one of the things that I always tell them is the most simple ideas are often the most powerful and therefore the most neglected. And this is one of those. We always look externally for validation. We always think if we do more, we can be more. But I'm just here to tell you, in my experience, my climb to the top of the mountain, that is not the case. And in fact, you'll recall in the book, Dov, I said that when I got to the top, there was nothing but a cold, howling wind.
Yeah.
Only void and more void on top of that.
I think that many leaders will listen to you say that and be nodding along. They get it, but it doesn't hit. It doesn't hit them. There's another part in the book, I think it might be in the chapter, A Plane to Nowhere, where you talk about being in the swimming pool with your little girl and realizing that you'd largely missed the first year of her life. That moment, like other moments, slipped by so many people. I fell off a mountain, and that was my fourth fall. And I always say, it was my fourth fall. I'm a slow learner. Why didn't I get it on the first fall or the second fall? Or why didn't I get it when I twisted my ankle? How dramatic does it need to be? And so being in that pool with your little girl and looking into her eyes and realizing, why do you think you had that awakening? You're talking about a series of awakenings. People talk about this moment, this, oh, God moment. That's bullshit. It doesn't happen like that. You have multiples until you get full, right? And for me, like I said, it was my fourth fall. But there were many other reasons that I had awakenings, but ignore them. And by the time I fell, I'd been on a spiritual journey for 20 years. And I'd been a therapist and I'd been in front of therapists and I'd taken every course you could possibly take. But that's different. That's the difference between, as you said, that's the difference between intelligence, gathering of information, and wisdom, which is experience plus failure. And suddenly it's like, oh, and sometimes, certainly for me, it was the gravitas of the accumulative negativity, the accumulative failure. So I've got this, I've learned all that, I've had this experience, I failed, and that's painful, but if I keep going down that road, where does that go? Was that the moment in the pool with you? Did you get to that moment of going, if I keep going down this road?
Yeah, I certainly did. I say in the book, and you understand that most often these revelations, these poignant moments, they don't come in meditation or prayer necessarily. That may be the table stakes or the groundwork
yes.
that kind of tills the soil in your soul, gets it ready. But it's really in quiet moments like this one of reflection with my daughter in the pool when I looked into her eyes. That's where the magic happens. And let me try to answer your question. No one's asked me this. So let me give you two thoughts. How did this happen or why did this happen? Let me just say one thing, just as a thought experiment. Is this the quote unquote grace of God? So the point is, it's the grace of the universe, of our higher selves, of God. So in one way, I can't answer, as I don't think anyone can necessarily answer, why me? Why now? Why this way? I don't know exactly. Let me pat myself on the back a little bit or say one thing that I think may have led to this. I'm fearless in following what I feel like I should do.
Mm.
You have to understand that releasing this book was a massive leap for me. Based on my community, based on where I live, based on my background, I am fearless in following what I'll call the heroic journey. And I think that's what we're on, both as individuals and collectively, especially in the age of AI. When I talk about a crucible, an almost kind of judgment day that AI is for us, this is pulling us, pushing us, pleading with us to lean into this heroic journey. And so the only thing that I could say that might be helpful is lean into that. Follow your intuition. Follow that inner voice. Don't be afraid to go inside. And then when you see what you see and it's not all pretty, acknowledge it with love, authenticity, and keep going. What's behind door number three? Don't shy away. You lean into door number three. I think I've obviously shown that in my life in starting multiple billion-dollar companies, in running for governor when I'm not a politician, and writing this cosmic book. I think that I am willing to lean into my own heroic journey. That would be the best answer that I could give you and the best maybe advice that I could give listeners. If this is something that's calling you, you can lean in fearlessly and with love, ease, love, and grace into what you see and into what comes. Maybe that's why.
I spent my early years traveling the world to study different religions and different philosophies. And when people ask me my religion, I will say that my religion is curiosity. And in many ways, what I'm hearing you say is leaning into soulful curiosity. As I read the book, and I have many friends who are Mormons who've grown up in the Church of Latter-day Saints, and I've interviewed several of them actually, and have that background there. This is not a Mormon book. I remember I was reading it and thinking, "Ooh, I think a couple of the people might be a bit pissed off about this." This does not seem to go the path. I wanted to ask you about that, actually. What is that like? You were a bishop in your faith. You weren't just like, "Oh, I go on Sunday." Let's be honest here. You don't fuck around. You get in with everything. Real estate. Oh, I'm going to run for politics. What? You're going to run for mayor? You maybe head of a committee? No, I'm going to go for governor. Let's just start with that. So you didn't mess about. You went into the big stuff. And you're the bishop with a community. So what was that like? I imagine a battle, because I can see you going for governor because Mitt Romney was governor. Okay, good. I can get there's a path there. But this book, in many ways, seems to be quite a deviation and might create some inner turmoil in you, not of who you are at a soulful level, but who you are at an identity level inside of your faith.
Absolutely. I viewed this book as my little piece of art, Dob. I mean, whether you experience that way or any reader does, I know a lot have. It doesn't really matter. The outcome isn't up to me. What I was fully committed to was the process of creating my own little piece of art. And whenever we step into that process wholeheartedly with our souls open, we don't know where it's going to take us. So this has been a very cosmic journey to bring me here. I negotiated, quote unquote, with God, argued, wrestled with him, with the universe, with it for years. I lost out of the governor's race 5 years ago, and I've been working on this book for 4 or 5 years, mainly because of what was coming out. At first, I'm not a writer. I'm okay, fine, I'll write. Oh, but I'm not going to write this. Okay, I'll write this, but I'm going to use a pen name, or I'm not going to say that I ate a mushroom. I'm going to say I had a dream, you know, like I'm going to talk about it in bullshit, half-ass ways. And of course, God said to me, you can't half-ass, either do this or don't do this. Don't half-ass this. Art can never be impactful when we half-ass it.
No.
In the end of the day, I couldn't go halfway. It was funny. I was golfing with my son a month or so ago. And I said, hey, how'd you experience the book? And he said, I enjoyed it. But Dad, why did you have to talk about tantric sex? Of course. And I said, oh, son, I'm so sorry, man. Like I had to either make a decision of whether I was going to go all in and be all in on the process, totally open and honest and vulnerable, or if I was going to hold back. And so that was part of the story. And that was part about being all in. I'm sorry it made you uncomfortable. But I would say that the response has been very, very largely positive. People can feel my heart and soul in the book. And I appreciate the grace, the understanding, the curiosity that others have largely shown me. Now, that hasn't been totally the case, as you might imagine. This book can be triggering because I don't hold back on what I see is the truth. I think this is the message for our moment. I think that as our machines become more and more intelligent, we as humans must become more wise. And that wisdom means looking in the mirror and talking truth, speaking truth, authentically owning our garbage, our mess, and showing up with ease, love, and grace in every way that we possibly can. And so anyways, it's been triggering to people, including my parents, which has been hard. There's been a personal cost. I think that's what always happens when we follow our heart. And by the way, I think that's what often happens when we create and put art into the world. Not everyone's going to love it.
But you said something there that I think is really important, because I think there's a lot of false equivalencies that go around. And often because of the nonsense we've been fed by algorithms for 100 years, well, not 100 years, but you know, the last few years particularly. And that is, everything's either or, black or white, right or wrong, red or blue. That's not the truth. And so the reason I'm sort of holding on to this piece here, Jeff, with you, is because you're a man of faith who wrote a book that in many ways challenges, or could be challenging to, people of faith. And you decided to follow your heart and follow your soulful sort of quest here, as you said, on the hero's journey. And so I'm just going to ask this simple question. I know the answer, but I'm going to ask it. Have you lost any faith?
No. My faith has increased.
Yes.
My faith in the human condition has maybe been hurt. We live, so many of us live most of our lives in unconscious patterns that we aren't even aware of. And those unconscious patterns control so much of our life. And so have I seen that on full display for good and bad as I've wrote and released the book? Absolutely. Has my faith in the ultimate divine purpose of mankind, of the universe, the good, the heart of the base substance being love, absolutely increased. I absolutely believe that. Now, we may be further behind than I would hope. I'm speaking generally as humanity, but that's why I wrote the book. I wrote the book to be a conversation starter so that we can start having conversations like this, Dov, of course, on podcasts, but also in boardrooms, and most importantly, around the dinner table. Where AI could really affect us is in relationship. And that's an important thing to discuss.
In part two of the show, I want to talk about bringing that into the organization, because there may be a tendency to want to make it, oh, it's woo-woo, and so we're not going to really bother with that. I want to talk about that. I want to talk about the reception to it from that point of view as well. I personally work with very high-profile leaders who are extraordinarily successful, and they definitely feel like they have to hide the stuff you're talking about. It's not there for the boardroom. So I want to talk about where that goes in part two of the show. But before we do that, I want to make sure that people know how to find out more about you, about the book, and about all the resources that you have. So please tell us.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I'm not hard to find. Jeff Burningham, like burning a ham. My website, jeffburningham.com. The book's for sale at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Target, Walmart, anywhere you want to see it. And I have very mixed feelings about social media, but I'm trying to go to where the people are. I mean, when you run for political office, you see the worst of social media. And so, but I'm at Jeff Burningham, believe me, I'm at Jeff Burningham on almost all the platforms. So I'd love to talk to people.
All right. We'll make sure that all those links are posted in the show notes. So if you didn't catch them, don't worry. We're going to be back in just one click for more of our delicious conversation with Jeff Burningham, like burning a ham, who is the author of The Last Book Written by a Human. We'll be back in just one click. Stay curious, my friends. Stay curious. Part two of our delicious conversation with Jeff Burningham. He is the author of The Last Book Written by a Human. Jeff grew up in Spokane, Washington. He's the oldest of six kids. He did his first entrepreneurial venture at 13. He went on from there to go and do all kinds of things, including running for governor. He went to Brigham Young University, and while doing his MBA, sold his company to a NASDAQ-listed company and then shifted that into a portfolio for real estate worth $2 billion. So he's got his hands deeply in business, comes from a business world. He also was a bishop. He comes from the faith base as well. And now he's written this book that, as we talked about in part one, is really asking us to look at how we are evolving ourselves. Now, let's start with that question, Jeff. You said the last book written by a human. Why did you choose that title? Because it could have been a book written by a human in the age of AI.
Yeah, two reasons. I wrote this book with all my heart and soul. I hope as you read it, you felt it. Like, it is very human. So the point is, I hope that there continues to be books written in this way. I wrote every single painstaking word. As you know, the foreword was actually written by ChatGPT. The rest of it was painstakingly written by a flawed but trying human, myself. Secondly, the way that I thought of the book, Dov, is there is so much coming at us. Social media, political division, just so much. If I were plopped onto this earth in 2025 with so much coming at me, with AI coming onto the scene, what would I want to get my hands on to? What would I want to read to try to kind of get my bearings of what in the world is going on here? How can I make a difference in a positive way? And that's what I'd want to read. The last book written by a human. As you know, the book is really about human nature.
Yes.
It's about AI, but it's really about human nature, because I think it's a belief to this wisdom that's embodied, a return to our bodies, a return to nature, a return to beautiful, messy human relationship. That's how we transform. And I'm trying to guide people or remind people, this is the process of transformation and evolution. So this is the book I would have wanted to get my hands on in 2025 if I just came to Earth and said, what in the hell is going on here?
Let's take that and look at that a little bit further structurally in the way you've laid out the book. You've decided, okay, if I come to Earth and I need a book that is the last book written by a human, this was the book you'd want to read. But then you've laid it out in a specific way. Walk us through that.
Yeah, what's interesting is, as an investor in hundreds of technology startups, I've seen this pattern repeatedly. This is how new technology comes into culture. Number one, what's interesting as I wrote the book is I think it mirrors our own existence, the heroic journey that we're all on. And that always starts with number one, disruption. As you know, Dov, change is the only constant. We can fight and push and hate that, or we can accept that with ease, love, and grace. But disruption is always where it starts. And that's the first section of the book. The second is reflection. What does this change mean for me? What does this new technology mean for me? How do I use it effectively and have it not use me? You could say in our age, how do I not get lost in the machine? How do I stay grounded here on Earth and not get lost in this digital world? So reflection was the second stage. That's often too where the hero declines the call, says, this isn't for me. I can't do it. Transformation is the third section. And that occurs when the hero says, we can do this. Let's lean in. What is really happening here? So transformation is all about love. It's about acceptance. It's about growth, both personally and collectively. And that's where I talk a lot about personal transformation in that third section. And then lastly, the last section is titled Evolution. And this is where I believe we're going. Once the hero has gone inside, done the work, they have some wisdom to then bring to the tribe, to bring to the world. And that's where we can naturally evolve our institutions. So I talk about reforming religion. I talk about conscious capitalism. I talk about a potential new political movement. The human political movement is what I call it. So that's how the book is laid out. It mirrors kind of the way that technology integrates into society. I think it also is a pattern for our own spiritual growth.
That's what I liked about it. What appealed to me about it was because I love investigating paradox, and this paradox of this machine that can bring us to our spiritual center without us. And this is the trip. There's always a trip. There's a tripwire without us turning it into God, which is the other side of it. So from that point of view, what is it that you sort of most fear about where we're going with AI, where we could get lost?
Yeah, I think the three stages of disinformation, unemployment, And then I don't know if you knew this, Dob, but I learned this when I ran for governor. I think the highest risk factor for war or for civil unrest is unemployment in males ages 18 to 40.
Disillusionment.
Yep. So you can see how this could lead to additional violence and almost third-party violence in that we could use AI to inflict harm upon other human souls, our brothers and sisters, so to speak. So I think my greatest fear is that we take the path of least resistance, that we triple and quadruple down on this old game that I think is crescendoing right now, this old game of division, greed, power. I think you see that crescendoing in politics, feel it. I think you see that crescendoing some economically. And I think it's time. I think we're wise enough. I think we're mature enough to lean into a new game where maybe money isn't the currency, but karma is the currency, where power isn't the reason or motivation. Authenticity is the real engine behind what's coming. And then where love is the reason, not control. This is a new paradigm. I mean, at least new for this day and age, let's say. And I think it's the opportunity that we have to transform and evolve ourselves. I see AI as a potential tool to, as I speak about in the book, upgrade the human condition, to upgrade existence for a lot of us. And that's the picture I try to paint. That's a direction I think we could go. It's not going to be easy. I'm not saying it's even likely, but I am saying it's possible.
Yeah, I think that we've got to recognize the possibility. But I think if we're going to be realistic, we also have to acknowledge the possibility in the other direction. I wrote a special report about transhumanism and the dangers of transhumanism. And in that report, which I was speaking on a lot last year, I talk about that I am understanding why people are terrified of AI, and I am totally understanding why people are excited about AI. And the challenge is this, is that in a business level, and we're going to talk about the business side of this, at a business level, this is the new money-making machine that's off the charts. Now, there are ecological issues with it in that it takes enormous amounts of power, enormous amounts of water that has to be quality drinking water. In a world where water is short in a lot of places and where power is short, we're building more and more clean power things, but we're using more energy than we've ever used. It's not even catching up. That's why fossil fuels are still so popular. So you've got all those kinds of things that are very real. And as I talked about in that report, if I said to you, do you think social media is good? Most people would say, oh, it's been a bit toxic, really. How's it impacted our kids? It's done this. What's it done to suicides in teens and et cetera, et cetera? And we'd all go, oh, shit. Okay, now we get in a time machine and we go back to just before the internet, because I'm old enough that I remember being at conferences talking about this thing that was coming called the internet. And then being at conferences talking about this thing called Internet 2.0, which would have moving pictures on it. And we'd have flash video. People are like, what the hell's flash video, Dove? Right? Yeah, I'm old. So,
and you look good, though.
If you could go back in time,
yeah,
what guidelines would you put in place that we should have put in place back then? And people are like, they've got a litany of things. Oh, this and this and this and this. And I go, but we didn't, did we? We were very excited. I was excited. I thought it was going to be the new town square where we'd all have a voice and it would be beautiful. It'd bring us together. That was the idea of it. It's not become that. The challenge is this, that now we have the opportunity to have guidelines for AI, guardrails. We're not having those. In fact, America and Britain have pushed very hard in making sure that we don't have those guidelines, that those guardrails are not in place. And that, for me, is the danger, is in the greed. We're moving towards a technocracy. People are worried about democracy. They've elected a socialist, communist. You know what? That's really not a problem. Your problem is a technocracy who is pulling all the strings behind that. And they're using AI. They're using all the algorithms to control us. If we can't get ChatGPT to do it, or Claude, or whatever it might be, how do we get to install the guidelines, that the guardrails within ourselves, and not become, quote, lazy, let it do our thinking for us? Because your book is about finding the wisdom. But at the same time, let's remember that the great seducer is comfort and ease, laziness.
Yeah, No, I mean, these are all great points, and these are all great questions in the age of the artificial. And this is what we get to determine together. I think that existence is a never-ending cycle of life, death, and rebirth. In fact, I start the book on the Ganges River in Varanasi, India. And I won't lay out the scene, but it's a very poignant scene of life, death, and rebirth.
And laundry.
And laundry. Yeah, well, that's life, man.
That's exactly it, right? It's birth, death, and laundry. As the Buddhists say, after enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. It's the same message. And I read that and I thought, oh yeah, that's beautiful.
Yeah. Well, and one thing I could just maybe say to sum it up, the more things change, Dov, the more they stay the same. Mm-hmm. The work that we have to do stays the same, whether it's via AI, whether it's pre-internet days. I think the work that we have stays the same, the human work that we have to do. So the paradox is, how do we stay embodied and human in a digital world? And that's a challenge for us all to face. That's something that we all need to grapple with. And I think that challenge starts within human relationship and families. How do we stay connected to humans when we know that that relationship is so beautiful, but so messy? It's so hard. It's where we're pulled out of our comfort zones. It's where we can become more. We're going to have to fight for human relationship, community, and connection. This is why I say in the book, I encourage people to return to their faith traditions, not because they have it all right or every dogmatic view or belief is correct, but because humans gather there. That's one of the places that humans come together. This is the game that we get to play with each other.
Yes.
And this is the never-ending game of life, death, and rebirth. There's going to be a lot of collective death here in the age of AI, meaning ego death, I hope. I hope it's not physical death. I hope it's ego death. We're going to be able to sacrifice our specialness, our tribal tendencies on the altar of unity and progress. And this is the time to lean into that. And there's so many, education's going to be disrupted, obviously. Religious belief or faith traditions disrupted, business disrupted. I say a couple times in the book, a new type of leader, I think, is being raised up. I think that the younger generation was built for this. I think they need a bridge, Dov, through people like you and I to kind of get there. But they were built for this. Let's provide a path and a way for these leaders to emerge and to hopefully take us to a beautiful place, a better place.
Let's take this into the boardroom because, as I said, you're from a background of business and you've done very well in business. It's not like you're some schmucko who's just decided on Tuesday, oh, you know. You have that background, you have that world. So what's happening when you're taking this into the boardroom? Not just the book, of course, but the message. Because it's like, well, hold on a second. We used to say that the CEO makes 20 times more than what the person on the floor makes. Now it's 400 times. The distance between the people at the top and the people at the bottom has gone vastly different. And now even the people at the top who are decent human beings, I work with many of them, wonderful people, but they're also like, you know what? I don't really have a choice here. I might look like I'm the boss, but really I have to answer to the shareholders and the board. And so, yeah, it's pretty unethical. I saw that at the White House when all the oligarchs of technology came together. And I went, are they just douchebags? And I went, no, I don't think they are. I don't think they're douchebags. I think they might be lacking a backbone, but I don't think they're douchebags. But it's like, how do you survive in an environment? Whether you call that environment Biden or Trump, doesn't matter. But how do you survive in an environment? So when you're taking this into the boardroom, what's the pushback and how do you deal with it?
Let me just be honest and say the results are mixed. Mm. I think we're in a transitionary stage. I think we're in a transformational point, a pivot point in history. This is my sense. And so the results are mixed. I would say that I'm talking to many CEOs, friends that are very open to these ideas, and they understand that it's time for them to step into their own hero's journey. I'll say it in this religious term. that you'll understand. It's time to lay our lives down for our friends. It's time for more of our leaders to do that. In other words, if I'm a politician and I care more about my reelection campaign than human flourishing in the age of AI, those are not the types of leaders that we want to elect. If I'm in a boardroom and I'm a CEO and I think that my quarterly profits are more important than the humans that I've hired, the purpose of business was to enable more humans to flourish, to live better lives, to have more resources that they then get to determine what to do with to make their and their family lives better. Let's remind ourselves of these simple principles that are here to stay. Let me just say again, I know this may sound Pollyanna, woo-woo, whatever. There's not another path. It's either this path or destruction, ultimately. In my opinion, we cannot keep going down the path we've been going and layer on this godlike technology of AI and have it be a bright future for our children and grandchildren. I just don't see how that works. So let's choose the better way. Let's pivot. Again, I think we're in a transitionary phase. There's pushback as well on this. I'm a hard-ass CEO. The bottom line is all that matters. Corporations exist not to serve employees, but to serve shareholders. This is a transition that we're going to be grappling with, I think, here over the next decade or more. But again, I think that AI brings these issues to a head. It's like it's time for us to really address these issues in a way that we haven't before.
And I agree with everything you're saying. The only challenge is, of course, that the system is built for that negative. It's built for the shareholders. As I said, I work with these amazing people who are beautiful human beings who feel hamstrung because they are really good at what they're doing and they can make the decisions they need to make that are hard decisions, but they don't necessarily sleep well because of them. Like you and I, they're going, no, there's got to be something better. But if I'm going to survive and if I'm going to take care of the people that I do employ and make sure they have a job and that they can pay their mortgage, I got to go along with this shit. I got to go along with this terrible stuff. And then we look at the political arena and where is the humanity? I'll give you one that I can see that stands out for me. James Tallarico, he's fantastic. He's a Christian man, ex-minister, who is running for governor in Texas, and I think he's governor. He says, most people who are claiming to be Christian have a mouth full of verse and a heart full of hate. Now, I'm not a Christian, and I would go to his church because I feel like I would be gathering with people who care about humanity. Do you see what I'm saying? Whenever anybody has shown up like that, that machine pushes hard against them. Again, you may not like Zoran in New York, but, you know, he's offering something that was seemed to be more human-based, whether we agree with the politics or not, but the machine pushes hard. And I think that maybe, whether you like him or not, maybe that seed you're talking about of, like, people are going, hold on a second. But again, they've had to go to that extreme where they're like, can I pay my rent? Can I buy groceries? And again, it's this moment of sitting in your MBA class and going, oh, shit. I've been chasing the wrong things. Or the moment in my life of falling off the mountain and going, oh shit, I've been all about my ego. So do we need that moment?
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I mean, this is going to be hard work. Systems are made up of people.
I agree.
And ideas, period. And so if enough people shift, if we can change ideas, if we can tell a little bit different story, if we want to understand and lean into this divine unity that I think underlies everything. When we understand that the division that politics, socioeconomics, etc., is sowing into us is largely illusory, we can write a different story. We can tell a different story. We can write a different narrative. So while I agree with you that this is very audacious and very hard to pull off, I just want to remind the listeners, humans built these systems. Humans can destruct these systems, change these systems. Now, I'm not calling for like violent revolution in the book.
But we do need a revolution. It's not violence.
But let me tell you the revolution, Dov. My bet is on a massive renaissance in human consciousness over the next decade.
Yeah.
That's my bet. That's like what I'm working towards. That's what I'm writing about. That's what I'm talking about every day. there are more people talking about that. And I think there will continue to be more and more talking about that. And our leaders are a reflection of us.
Absolutely.
So as we change over time, our leaders will change. And our leaders will take us to different places than we have been before. My bet is on a renaissance in human consciousness, and that's what's going to take us there. I know that sounds woo-woo and weird. Dov, what's a better answer?
It's really interesting because a couple of years ago, I wrote an article, and this was before AI was big, but what I talked about was how we are on the brink of a renaissance. I talked about Michelangelo and Da Vinci and all those people we think of as being part of the Age of Enlightenment, the Renaissance. And I talk about what was going on 30 years before. It was the Black Plague. It was horrible, horrible shit. And if you were in it, you'd be like, oh my God, this is hell. It's hell. And out of that comes the Renaissance. And I think that in many ways, it seems pretty black right now for a lot of people. And my question in that article is, what if this is the preliminary to it? Human beings need enough pain to change. Then we look around at this political nonsense that we're living in, not just in America, but across the world. And we're seeing the uprise of dictatorial and authoritarian and technocrats and oligarchs. Is this the point where the people wake up and say, hold on, we need a renaissance? And I am fully with you. I think we need a spiritual, social, certainly emotional, psychological renaissance. And I think we can bring it, but we have to commit to doing it. And that will mean facing your own ego and facing the forces around you the way that you have talked about that you had to do. It doesn't mean you've stopped being a Mormon. It doesn't mean you've stopped being a business person, but you've become a human who is embedded or committed to being embedded in wisdom. And that, I think, is the key to it, is that I've got to get out of the way of my pursuit of comfort into my pursuit of something greater in the world. Your book opens with death. It ends with rebirth. So let me ask you this question as we come towards the end of the show. What part of Jeff Birmingham still has to die?
I love this. My hair is all gone on the top of my head, so it's not that. I believe in the flow of the universe. I believe that there is a divine plan to kind of all of this. So what does AI have to do with that? So because of those things, Dov, I need to continue to live as absolutely in non-resistance as I possibly can. In other words, not my will be done, you know, so to speak, God's will be done or the universe's will be done. I need to continue to have faith in living in non-resistance and not worrying about outcomes. This is a process of transformation that we are all in. And what we spoke about today, a lot of it's really easy to talk about when we're in our nice little offices and studios. We're two handsome dudes shooting the shit, you know, talking about whatever. No, the rubber meets the road when we hang up this call and we have got to catch up on all our messages and we've got business that and family this and personal that, you know, that's where the rubber meets the road. And I am trying my damnedest to live in non-resistance and let go of outcomes because some things, Dov, are worth our best efforts no matter the outcome. And I think this is one of those things. Humans rehumanizing themselves, leaning into and pointing AI towards human flourishing. Let's not worry about the outcome. Let's not worry if it's going to be Terminator or Nirvana. Let's worry about the process, the transformational process that we're all going through. So the two things I need to let go of are resistance to what is and being attached to any outcomes. Whether I sell 10,000 books or 10 million books, you know, I'm going to give it my best effort. I can't be attached to outcomes. And so those are two things that I'm continuing to work on and trying to let, I guess you could say, die in my heart is kind of my will. I know better. This is the way it should go. No, I think it should go the way that God or the universe would have it go. And so anyways, those are things that I'm continuing to work on.
Beautiful. Well, as we come to the end of the show now, let me ask you if there's a final practical message So not just a philosophical, but a practical sort of guidance message you would want to the listener, the viewer, walk away with and go, I can do that. What would it be?
Could I do three things real quick?
Sure.
Number one, sit today in silence and do nothing for 10 minutes, 20 minutes, however long you can.
Hold on. Let me help you. Start with two. Put a timer on your phone. Put your phone over there and start with two, only focusing on your breath. Believe me, if you've not done it before, it's going to be a bloody long 2 minutes. But you have to start somewhere.
And quit judging yourself. You're going to think you're doing it wrong. There's no wrong way to meditate or to sit still. Just sit still and breathe, number one. Number two, get back into nature. Do something in flow, whether that's surfing or hiking in nature. Nature is exhibiting to us the reality of what is all the time. And it's a grounded energy. And when we connect to it, we change. We can't become disembodied in this digital age.
Just before you go on to number three, if I may just add something to number two.
Yeah.
So the Japanese talk about forest bathing. And what that means is that when you're spending your time in nature, so there is a particular resonance of the planet, and we come into alignment with that when we're in nature. So simply sitting, walking, being in nature, this is what tree hugging is all about. Your resonance starts to shift and you come out of the fight or flight and you come into the sympathetic nervous system and you start to relax. If you want to really get over anxiety and you have a tree close by, be a hippie. Go hug the tree. Not because it's like, ooh, I'm now going to start wearing tie-dye, but because the resonance of the planet moves through you. And if you can't do that, take your shoes off and stand on bare ground. Not concrete, but the grass. Stand on it and it will shift your resonance. So number two is a fabulous one too. Thank you.
Yeah. And the third, put down your phone, turn off the TV. I don't know. Close your laptop and call someone. Tell them you love them. Go hug your partner, your kids. Look them in the eye. Be present. So there's three very practical, simple things. Sit with yourself in silence, doing nothing for 2 minutes. Dov gave you the 2 minutes instead of 10. He's a much nicer teacher than me. Connect with nature and then go be present with another human. Listen to them. Look into their eyes. When we look into the eyes of another human, we're looking into the eyes of God. We're looking into our own eyes. And it's that connection that will feed us, that will transform us in the age of highly intelligent machines.
Beautiful. Thank you. I wrote a report called The Loneliness Tax. We are mostly very lonely people. And the ones who claim not to be lonely, we are often isolated. We might not be lonely, but we're isolated. As Jeff just said, looking into the eyes of another human being. How often when you kiss your wife, do you actually look at her, or you kiss your husband or your partner? Do you look at them? Actually take a moment to just look into the eyes of that person. It changes your neurochemistry, changes your brain chemistry, and makes you a better human being. You can't hurt someone and look in their eyes, right? It's really important. So Jeff, this has been a fabulous conversation. I hope you will stay with us to the end. I want to thank you for being with us. I want to thank you for all you've shared. Please tell our viewers and our listeners where they can find out more about you.
Yeah, jeffburningham.com is my website. I'm not hard to find. I'm on social media at that same handle. And the book, the last book written by a human, is available everywhere. You can buy books, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Walmart, Target. It's a great gift. I hope that you resonate with it. I wrote it to be a conversation starter. So after you read it, let me know what you think. Let's talk.
Fabulous. And again, thank you, Jeff. It's been a pleasure and an honor for you, dear listener. Remember, those who control the meaning for the tribe also control the movement of the tribe. Leaders who are committed to positively shaping the political and business landscape know that they must tap into what drives human behavior. I'm Dov Barron. I show businesses, teams, and leaders how to harness their emotional source code to move their tribe. Because unified, actualized meaning is the single monolithic difference between mediocrity and greatness for all individuals and for companies. Remember, we need your help in staying relevant, so please go to wherever it is that you tune into the show from. Do us a favor, hit that button, rate, review, and subscribe. And of course, a big thank you to you for making this show so successful and sharing the show with everybody you know. It makes a huge difference, and we really appreciate it. Till next time, stay curious, my friends. Stay curious how you can not just get more intelligent, but get wiser. And how do you get wiser? You get wiser through experience, through failure, by embracing those, but most of all, by embracing your humanity. I'm Dov Barron. I'm here to assist you tapping into your deepest meaning to reach that next level of clarity, focus, purpose, and profit in your business, in your life, in your leadership impact. And I am out.